She picked out a line of hieroglyphics and followed them with her finger as she read aloud, "The vulture rises on mighty pinions to greet the sun. The jackal howls and turns upon his tail. The river flows towards the earth. Beware, you violators of the sacred places, lest the wrath of all the gods descend upon you." "It's nonsense jargon. It does not make sense," he protested. "Oh, yes, it makes sense, all right. Taita always makes sense once you follow the way his oblique mind is working." She turned to face him squarely. "Don't look so glum, Nicky. You can't expect to read Taita like an editorial in the Times. He has set us a riddle that may take weeks and months of work to unravel. Well, one thing is certain. We can't stay here in the muck dust for weeks and months while we puzzle it out. Let's get to work." "Photographs first." She became brisk and businesslike. "Then we can lift impressions from the stone." He set down the camera bag and knelt over it to open the flap. "I'll shoot two rolls of colour first and then use the Polaroid. That'll give us something to work on until we have the colour developed." She stood out of his way as he circled the pillar on his knees, keeping the angle correct so as not to distort the perspective. He took a series of shots of each of the four sides, using different shutter speeds and exposures. "Don't use up all your film," she warned him. "We need some shots of the walls of the tomb itself." Obediently, he went to the grill gates and studied the locking system. "Oh, this is a bit more complicated than the outer gate. If I try to get in here, I might do some damage. I don't think it'll be worth the risk of being discovered." "All right," she agreed. "Work through the openings in the grill." He filmed as best he was able, extending the camera through the openings at the full stretch of his arms and estimating his focus. "Well, that's the lot," he told her at last. "Now for the Polaroids." He changed cameras and repeated the entire process, but this time Royan held a small tape measure against the pillar to give the scale. As he exposed each plate, he handed it to her to check the development. Once or twice, when the flash setting on the camera had either overexposed or rendered the subject too dull, or for some other reason she was not satisfied, she asked him to repeat the shot. After almost 2 hours' work, they had a complete set of Polaroids, and Nicholas packed his camera away and brought out the roll of art paper. Working together, they stretched it over one face of the pillar and secured it in place with masking tape. Then he started at the top and she at the bottom. Each with a black art crayon, they rubbed the precise shape and form of the engravings onto the sheet of blank paper. "I have learned how important this is when dealing with Taita. If you are not able to work with the original, then you must have an exact copy. Sometimes the most minute detail of the engraving may change the entire sense and meaning of the script. He layers everything with hidden depths. You have read in River God how he considers himself to be the riddler and punster par excellence, and the greatest exponent of the game of bow ever lived. Well, that much of the book is accurate. Wherever he is now, he knows the game is on, and he is reveling in every move we make. I can just imagine him giggling and rubbing his hands together with glee." "Bit fanciful, dear girl," he settled back to work, "but I know what you mean." The task of transferring the outline of the designs onto the blank sheets of art paper was painstaking and monotonous, and the hours passed as they laboured on hands and knees or crouched over the granite pillar. At last, Nicholas stepped back and massaged his aching back. "That does it, then. All finished." She stood up beside him. "What time is it?" she asked, and he checked his wristwatch. 4 in the morning. "We'd better tidy up in here. Make certain we leave no sign of our visit." "One last thing," Royan said, tearing a corner off one of the sheets of art paper. With it she went to the altar where the abbot's crown lay. Quickly she taped the scrap of paper over the blue ceramic seal in the centre of the crown and filled it with a rubbing of the design of the hawk with a broken wing. "Just for luck," she explained to him, as she came back to help him fold the long sheets of paper and pack them back in the bag. Then they gathered up the shreds of discarded masking tape and the empty film wrappers that he had strewn on the stone slabs. Before they covered the granite stele with damask cloth, Royan caressed the stone panels of script as if to take leave of them forever. Then she nodded at Nicholas. He spread the cloth over the pillar, and they adjusted the folds to hang as they had found them. From the threshold of the brass-bound door, they surveyed the Muqaddas for the last time. Then he opened the door a crack. "Let's go." She squeezed through, and he followed her out into the kist of the church. It took him only a few minutes to slide the tongue of the lock back into place. "How will we get out through the main doors?" she asked. "I don't think that will be necessary. The priests obviously have another entrance, from their quarters, directly into the quiddist. You very seldom see them using the main gates." He stood in the centre of the floor and looked around carefully. "It must be on this side if it leads directly into the monks' living quarters." He broke off with a grunt of satisfaction. "Aha! You can see where all their feet have actually worn a pathway over the centuries." He pointed out a smooth area of dished and worn stone near the side wall. "And look at the marks of grubby fingers on the tapestry over there." He crossed quickly to the hanging and drew a fold aside. "Yes, I thought as much." There was a narrow doorway concealed behind the hanging. "Follow me." They found themselves in a dark passageway through the living rock. Nicholas flashed his torch down its length, but he masked the bulb with his hand to show only as much light as they needed. "This way." The passage turned at right angles, and ahead they could make out a dull illumination. Nicholas switched off the torch and led her on. Now there was the smell of stale food and humanity, and they passed the doorless entrance to a monk's rock cell. Nicholas flashed his torch into it. It was deserted and bare. A wooden cross hung on the wall with a truckle bed below it. There were no other furnishings. They went on past a dozen others, which were almost identical. At the next turning of the passage, Nicholas paused. He felt a tiny draught on his cheek, and the taste of fresh air on his tongue. "This way," he whispered. They hurried on until Royan grabbed his shoulder from behind and forced him to stop. "What?" he began. But she squeezed his shoulder to silence him. He heard it then, the sound of a human voice echoing eerily through the labyrinth of passageways. Then came a weird, haunting cry, that of a soul in agony, wailing and sobbing. They crept forward, trying to make their escape before they were discovered, but the sounds grew stronger as they went on. "Dead ahead," Nicholas warned her in a whisper. "We're going to have to sneak past." Now they saw soft yellow lamplight spilling from the doorway of one of the cells into the passage. There came another heart-rending female cry that echoed down the passage and froze them in their tracks. "That's a woman's voice. What's happening?" Ryan breathed. But he shook his head for silence and led her on. They had to pass the open door of the lit cell. Nicholas edged towards it with his back flattened to the opposite wall. She followed him, keeping close and clinging to his arm for comfort. As they looked into the cell, the woman cried out again, but this time her voice blended with that of a man. It was a duet without words, but racked with all the feral agony of a passion too fierce to be borne in silence. In their full view, a couple lay naked upon the truckle bed. The woman lay spread-eagled, holding the man's hips between her uplifted knees. Her arms wound hard around his back, upon which each separate muscle stood out proudly and gleamed with sweat. He thrust down into her savagely, his buttocks bunching and pounding with the force of a great black battering ram. She rolled her head from side to side, as another incoherent cry was torn from her straining throat. It seemed too much for the man above her to bear, and he reared back like a flaring cobra, his pelvis still locked to hers, but his back arched like a war bow. Spasm after spasm gripped him. The sinews in the back of his legs were stretched to snapping point, and the muscles in his back fluttered and jumped like separate living creatures. The woman opened her eyes and looked directly at them as they stood transfixed in the doorway. But she was blinded with the strength of her passion. Her eyes were sightless as she cried aloud to the man above her. Nicholas drew Royan away, and they slipped down the passageway and out onto the deserted terrace. They stopped at the foot of the staircase and breathed the sweet, cool night air that was perfumed by the waters of the Nile. "Tessé has gone to him," Royan whispered softly. "For tonight, at least," Nicholas agreed. "No," Royan denied. "You saw her face, Nicky. She belongs to Mac Nimmer now." The dawn was flushing the serrated crests of the escarpment to the colours of port wine and roses when they reached camp and separated at the door to Royan's hut. "Oh, I'm bushed," she told Nicholas. "The excitement has been too much for me. You won't see me again before noon." "Good thinking. Sleep as long as you wish. I want you scintillating and perceptive when we start going over the material which we gathered last night." It was long before noon, however, when Nicholas was woken from a deep sleep by the harsh and intrusive bellows of Boris as he stormed into the hut. "English, wake up. I must talk to you. Wake up, man, wake up." Nicholas rolled over and thrust one arm out from under the mosquito net as he groped for his wristwatch. "Damn you, Brusilov. What the hell do you want?" "My wife. Have you seen my wife?" "Now, what has your wife got to do with me?" "She has gone. I have not seen her since last night." "The way you treat her, that comes as no stunning surprise. Now go away and leave me to sleep." "The whore has run off with that black bastard, Mac Nimmer. I know all about them. Don't try and protect her, English. I know everything that goes on around here. You are trying to cover for her. Admit it." "Get out of here, Boris. Don't try and involve me in your sordid private life." "I saw you and that Schufter bastard talking in the skinning hut the other night. Don't try to deny it, English. You are in this thing with them." Nicholas flung back the mosquito net and jumped out of his bed. "Kindly moderate your language when you talk to me, you great oaf." Boris backed off towards the door. "I know that she has run away with him. I searched for them all last night at the river. They have gone, and most of his men with them." "Good for Tessé. She's showing some taste in men for a change." "You think I will let the whore get away with this? You are wrong, very wrong. I am going to follow them and kill them both. I know which way they are headed. You think I am a fool? I know all about Mac Nimmer. I was head of intelligence." He broke off as he realized what he had said. "I will shoot him in the belly and let that whore Tessé watch him die." "If you are going after Mac Nimmer, then my bet is that you won't be coming back." "You don't know me, English. You beat me up one night when I had a bottle of vodka in my belly. So you think I am easy, da? Well, Mac Nimmer will see how easy I am." Boris flung out of the hut. Nicholas pulled on a shirt over his shorts and followed him. Back in his own hut, Boris had flung a few essential items into a light pack. Now he was stuffing cartridges into the magazine of his .30-06 hunting rifle. "Let them go, Boris," Nicholas advised him in a more reasonable tone of voice. "Mech is a tough lad. They don't come tougher. And he has a war party of 50 men with him. You are old enough to know that you can never hold on to a woman by force. Let her go." "I do not want to hold on to her. I want to kill her. The safari is over, English." He flung a pair of keys on a leather tag on the floor at Nicholas's feet. "There are the keys to the Land Cruiser. You can make your own way back to Addis from here. I will leave 4 of my best men to look after you and hold your hand. Leave the big truck for me to use. When you get to Addis, leave the keys of the Land Cruiser with my tracker, Ali. I will know where to find him later. I will send you the money I owe you for cancellation. And don't worry, I am a man of principles." "How could I ever doubt it?" Nicholas smiled. "Goodbye, old chum. I wish you luck. You'll need plenty of that if you're going up against Mac Nimmer." Boris was several hours behind his quarry, and as soon as he had left the camp, he broke into a jog trot that carried him down the pathway to join the main track to the west, towards the Sudanese border. He ran like a scout, with an easy swinging gait that ate up the ground. "It looks as though he's still in good shape, even with the vodka." Despite himself, Nicholas was impressed as he watched him go. "But I wonder how long he'll be able to keep up that pace.